Welcome to Venango County Tea Party Patriots audio interview with the candidates. These interviews are provided as a service to those who want to be informed and educated voters. Venango County Tea Party Patriots is an affiliate of the National Tea Party Patriots, a grassroots organization of voters interested in protecting our Constitution and keeping elected officials accountable to their oath of office. Local meetings are held on the fourth Saturday of every month at 9 a.m. unless otherwise noted in the newspaper or on our email list. If you consider yourself a patriot and would like to be a part of this group, you can email Jane at vcTPP.org. That's Jane at vcTPP.org or call 814-671-7110. That's 814-671-7110. And now to our interview. Our guest today is Peg Luxick, and she will be running as a candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania in the May primaries. And for a lot of us, we may not know exactly what the Lieutenant Governor does. So we'll start off by giving you a little introduction to that position. The Lieutenant Governor is the second highest elected official in the state, and as such has a great deal of influence on state policy and the establishment of spending priorities. As the President of the Senate, the Lieutenant Governor presides over debate in that chamber and oversees the movement of legislation through the chamber. While they cannot vote for or sponsor legislation, they do work with advocates in the Senate to introduce the legislation. If the governor is incapacitated temporarily, the lieutenant governor exercises the powers of the governor, and if the governor dies or otherwise can no longer fulfill his duties, the lieutenant governor serves the governor's unexpired term. And so we have Peg Luxick, who is going to be running for this position. Welcome, Peg. Glad to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you think you're qualified to run for Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania and why you want the job?
That's a big question. Let me start with just the personal information. My husband and I have been married for nearly 39 years. We have 6 children, and now we're grandparents, which is just the most wonderful thing. I should have done that first. I am by trade originally a teacher. I've taught everything from preschool through college in pretty much every educational setting you can imagine. I was an advisor to President Reagan's Commission on the Family. I worked specifically in areas of adoption and welfare reform, but when you are an advisor to an administration, you see a lot of what's going on in a lot of areas. In Pennsylvania, I was a founding board member of the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference and the Pennsylvania Family Institute. I was also the strategist behind the passage of the Homeschooling Act in our state. So anyone who homeschools their children in Pennsylvania, you're quite welcome because I'm the strategist who made that occur. I worked for the U.S. Department of Education for several years. My job was to review and evaluate education reform initiatives, and then I became a leading national opponent of outcome-based education, which, of course, now Common Core. And so for the past several years, I've traveled the country talking about education policy in opposition to the federal overreach that we call Common Core. I get asked a lot, why are you qualified? Because for the past 30 years, I've worked in government. Now, I've always been a private citizen. I've never been a paid employee, well, except for the Department of Education, of the government. But I've gotten legislation passed and or defeated and have worked with folks both at the state and the federal level for several decades. So I have a long experience in getting things done. I got asked in one interview, the lieutenant governor is the president of the Senate, and the Senate runs by parliamentary procedure. And somebody asked me, do you know how that works? I've been of many nonprofit boards. In one government, it was a committee meeting, and a vote was taken, and it was a tie vote. And so they gave it to the yeses. And I was the person from the audience who said, no, in a tie vote, the noes win. You have to actually win the vote to win the vote. And the whole place stopped, and the chairman turned around and said, she's the only one in the room who knows how the system works. So that was kind of a sad compliment, but a compliment to me that I have a long experience and do know how things get done. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very helpful when you're involved in government. You do need to know how the process works.
Yes, yes. Well, if you would to get this job, what would it entail for you? I mean, given your priorities.
You know, the lieutenant governor is, unless they take over, and in the 1990s, twice, the lieutenant governor stepped into the governor's chair, Mark Single temporarily when Governor Casey had surgery, and then Mark Schweiker permanently when Tom Ridge was appointed to Homeland Security. From the lieutenant governor's chair, most lieutenant governors don't use the bully pulpit of the second highest office in the state. I don't plan to repeat that. My passion has been education. Our children are our future, and the fact that we are allowing our children to be experimented on with Common Core and now all of the social and emotional learning that they're doing and the data that they're collecting on the children, they need an advocate who will speak out for them. You know, I'm 5'2", so my speaking for the little guy is actually kind of appropriate. And I do believe that it's time that our children have a voice. I think it's time that the person that we don't have big special interest groups representing us. We're the people who do our jobs and pay the bills and fund all the crazy programs that so many of the special interest groups want, and then fund the fix to the program that didn't work, and yet nobody thinks about us. I believe that this position is a uniquely qualified, it's such an amazing platform to enable someone to speak for the actual people. You know, I've kind of made a lifetime doing that. I come from the people. And I think it's time we had someone in Harrisburg who spoke for them, whether it's the child in the classroom or the you know, person just trying to make ends meet and raise their family and make a living. No one speaks for them. Well, it's time somebody did.
Mm-hmm. Well, principles mean a lot. And I know that you know this interview is being conducted on the behalf of Tea Party Patriots. We're hoping a lot of people get to listen to this, but we have principles in the Patriots too, and they're constitutionally limited government, free market economics, and fiscal responsibility. How would you say that you line up with these principles?
Well, I've kind of been fighting for them for quite a long time. You know, in terms of, and what I'm publicly saying, for example, look at the property tax issue. It's an antiquated system. We have people who have, they bought their homes, they paid their mortgage, they did everything they were supposed to do, and now because school districts basically have a free rein to raise taxes, people are losing homes that they've bought and paid for property taxes. That's wrong. And so not only have I said that, but I worked with the Pennsylvania Liberty Alliance to do a series of commercials to help educate people on the issue and have made it something that I talk about in pretty much every appearance so that folks understand how property tax works and that there are alternatives out there and we need to continue to look for more. So when we talk about fiscal responsibility, the government needs to learn that the taxpayers' pockets are not an unending well. That anytime they want more money, they reach into our pockets. No, they need to learn to control how they spend and what they spend. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important part of the conversation that in many ways has been missing. And it's one that we need to change the dynamics of.
Well, it sounds like you're right on target with We the People there. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the rights of the people that you would be protecting. Say, address the right to life issue.
Well, you know, interestingly, I've kind of been involved in the pro-life movement. That's where I, way back in the 80s, actually began working, was in the Right to Life movement. I've not only attended 14-plus marches for life in Washington, I've spoken at the March for Life. Founded an organization that was an alternative to abortion to give young single women an opportunity to complete their education so that the choice for life did not have to be a choice for policy. It was actually named a national point of life by George Bush because it was so successful. I think right now one of the saddest pieces of legislation that I have seen in a long time is that right here in Pennsylvania, we are having to pass a law that says that a child being diagnosed with Down syndrome cannot be killed because of that diagnosis, that we have to protect an unborn child with Down syndrome. When did we get to be a country where you had to be good enough to be born? Isn't that a sad statement on the affairs of America? We, you know, that right to life is not just about abortion. It's about all of us. There's a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, I'm already born, so it doesn't matter to me. If the government can say that any individual or group is not entitled to even exist, then the government can say that about every individual and every group. Our right to exist, to live, is outside of the purview of any legitimate government, and we all need to be standing up and saying so.
Mm-hmm. And so how would you address the question of our Second Amendment rights, or the right to liberty, for instance?
You know, I don't know, just today, I don't know if you heard about it yet, there was, it just came across the wires, there was a school in Maryland, and a shooter went into the school. Thank God nobody was killed. You know who else we should thank? The armed security guard who shot the shooter before that shooter could create another massacre. It is absolutely ridiculous to blame the NRA and innocent gun owners for the crimes of a crazy person and the breakdown of law enforcement. You know, in the tragedy in Florida, those police were called multiple times. The FBI was contacted. They didn't do their job. So the right to bear arms is the one that protects all the rest. And thankfully, just in the very recent past in Maryland, because someone did exercise those Second Amendment rights, children were saved.
Pretty good visual aid lesson, if you will. Okay, we've addressed the right to life and the right to liberty. How about the right to pursue happiness?
You know, that's actually a kind of a multi-pronged piece, because it's unfortunately misinterpreted by many to say it's the right to be happy. That's not what it means. It means the right to become the person you were created to be. That begins by, I can own my own property. I have the right to the fruits of my labor. That's the free market system, the whole capitalist system, that I have the right to the fruits of my labor. I should also have the right to interact with my creator. Isn't it ridiculous that in so many of our public institutions, people are not only allowed but encouraged to kneel in disrespect for the American flag, but forbidden to kneel in respect for the creator who endowed them with the rights at all? Our right to pray, our right to interact with our creator, is fundamental to our freedoms, and it's one that we should not just give away lightly. You know, what you hear is, well, the courts have decided. Yeah, I don't actually believe in the infallibility of the United States Supreme Court. So when they make a bad decision, I think we need to keep coming back and coming back and coming back until they fix it and not just give up because the courts have spoken. Yes. The same with conscience rights. You know, if I'm going to become the person I was created to be, then I have to be able to live in accord with the dictates of my conscience. Now, we recognize that in the military and always have because we allow conscientious objectors for religious reasons, whether they're Quakers or Amish or other folks whose religion precludes them from participating in a war setting. As a matter of fact, there was a movie, what's it called, Heartbreak Ridge, about he was a medic. He won the Medal of Honor, and he wouldn't touch a gun. We do recognize that people have the right to conscience. Then why don't we recognize that in public discourse? Why? How ridiculous that we force people to bake a cake, or healthcare workers who are not allowed to abstain from participating in abortions or other medical procedures that violate the dictates of their conscience. We, as a free society, need to recognize that people have the right to act in accord with their conscience, and we need to be respecting that. There isn't one-size-fits-all conscience. We need to respect the rights of people to live in accord with those dictates, because that's what religious freedom is about. At the same time, when we talk about pursuing happiness, that really involves our relationship with the government. And the government doesn't have rights. The government only has responsibilities. And the authority that they exercise is the authority we give them to honor the responsibilities we have entrusted to them, and no more. Which means that everything that the government does needs to be clearly laid out on the table for us. There should never be hidden government assets. you know, when the budget in Pennsylvania last year, when remember they passed the budget that didn't balance, and the Common Sense Caucus found a government fund that had $400 million to balance the budget, except most people didn't know that that fund was there. Mm-hmm. That should never be. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, I think last summer or last spring, ran an article talking about school districts that are sitting on millions of dollars in reserve funds while they're raising property taxes. No, that should not be either. Every asset that the government has is really the people's asset, and the government is entrusted with it. You don't hide a trust fund. Those should be openly on the table so we know exactly what money the government has and where that money exists so that we can know how are they managing, do they actually need more, or are they hoarding something that more appropriately belongs to the people. The same thing is true for taxes. Every tax should be clearly labeled. You know, it's kind of funny when you go to a grocery store and you pick up a box of crackers. You can turn it around and see every ingredient that's in the crackers and every how many grams and all the pieces, like everything is clearly labeled. If you go to a fast food place, it tells you how many calories are in every single thing that you purchase. It's right on the marquee there because it's good to be clearly labeled. Well, then the government should follow its own rules, and taxes should be clearly labeled. Let me give you two examples. Pennsylvania has the highest gas tax in the nation. So if you buy gas in Pennsylvania, you are spending 77 cents for every gallon, and 55 cents of that is Pennsylvania tax. Well, if that's a 10-gallon tank, that means every time you put 10 gallons, you fill up your tank, you're handing the state $5. Now, when they raised that tax, they said it was to take care of all of the roads. But now we're finding out that a lot of that money is being diverted to the state police instead of the roads. Mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. The tax isn't clearly labeled, and then they're not doing with it what they said they were going to do with it.
Exactly.
That's wrong, because you can't hold government accountable if you don't know what they're doing. The next example is sadly hilarious. I live in Johnstown. And when the floods happened in Johnstown and the city needed to be rebuilt, the state passed an emergency tax on alcohol that was, at the time, 10% on every bottle of alcohol that was sold in the state store. And it was actually called the Johnstown Emergency Tax. And all the money, in fact, did go to rebuild the city of Johnstown, except then the city was rebuilt. And the state, instead of ending the tax, diverted the money into the general fund. And in the 1960s, they raised it to 15%, and now it's 18%. They raised it twice. All the money goes into the general fund. Now, when you go into a state store and you purchase a bottle of alcohol, the first thing that happens is there's a federal excise tax that gets added to it, and then the PLCB, the Liquor Control Board, adds a 30% fee on top of it. That's their profit margin, and redid the alcohol bill to allow things to like beer and stuff to be sold in grocery stores, they allowed the PLCB to add to that without any legislative oversight. So they actually raised it. And in the articles at the time, they said, this is more money in the general fund. But, of course, it's not labeled as that on the price of the bottle that you're buying. So you go in, and first there's a federal tax, and then there's the 30% PLCB tax, which is now 31%. And they add all of those three numbers together, and then they charge you 18% on top of that, which is the Johnstown emergency tax, except that's all going into the general fund. And then they add all of those numbers together, and then they charge sales tax on top of that. So you are paying tax on your tax on your tax, except everything but the sales tax was hidden inside the price of the alcohol.
And what's sad is they're getting away with it.
How many other stealth taxes are running around out there?
That's right.
That we don't know about.
Yes.
That's wrong. You can't hold government accountable if you don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, when folks talk about reforming, you hear a lot of big ideas. These are things that they not only can be done, they should have been done a long time ago. They are common sense. They are things that the average person can understand and that we can insist what are you doing with the money and where are you getting it from? Because then we can take intelligent action to hold them more accountable. And the third piece of that is that any government entity that does levy a fee or a tax on the citizens should be subject to legislative oversight.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called taxation without representation.
Yes, I think
and
you're right.
I seem to remember we fought a war about that.
Yes, yes, I think you're right.
And yet here we are doing it again. So whether it's the PLCB or the Turnpike Commission that is raising every year, those tolls go up. And yet every year we hear about corruption. Well, wait a minute, where's the legislature?
Mm-hmm.
Only the legislature should be allowed to tax us because we can hold them accountable. So unelected bureaucrats should never have the ability to reach into our pockets. Those are conversations we need to have
mm-hmm.
because they begin the bigger conversation about holding government accountable. But you can't hold them accountable if you don't know what they have or what they're doing.
That's right. Well, methinks, Peg, that you may have too much common sense for this job.
I know.
You sound like a teacher who has taught
the people. It's like, this is how you would approach something. This is how I would approach something. This is how your neighbors
sure.
would approach it. Well, like, before we can make a decision, let's see, what do we have and what are we doing with it?
That's
okay,
right.
Now we can make intelligent decisions. But the government does so much behind closed doors that it's impossible for citizens to interact effectively because we are so often kept in the dark.
Mm. Well, in the few minutes that we have left, I'm going to give you a couple other areas that you can maybe just touch on briefly, if you would, what the state's responsibility, in your opinion, in protecting our citizens in relation to, number one, sanctuary cities, and number two, the opioid drug epidemic that we seem to find ourselves in.
Actually, that's the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we look at there are a number of pieces to the opioid epidemic, but one of them is the amount of drugs that are pouring across the borders. Earlier this year, maybe about 6 weeks ago, there was an investigative report, and they talked about how much of the, many of the drugs that used to be, illegal drugs that used to be made here, they're not anymore. They're being made in Mexico and flying across the border. And the Trump administration has their confiscation rate is like 17% more than previously, and people are saying, oh, that means more drugs are coming. No, it means they're grabbing more, but they're still coming. And so when we look at the opioid crisis, we need to begin by saying closing those borders
mm-hmm.
is a top priority, because if we could stop the flow of the illegal drugs coming in, that's going to help to dry up the supply that the dealers and the pushers use on the streets of our cities. So the step number, those two pieces are actually linked together. And the folks pushing sanctuary cities who somehow think the laws don't apply to them are enabling that kind of a drug culture that is destroying so many of our young people in the inner cities. Look at like the MS-13 gang
mm-hmm.
and many of these other drug gangs that the Trump administration is making it a priority to round them up. Yay, we need to continue that. And there needs to be support from the state level to say, we're going to be cooperating with the federal government. We're going to be rounding these folks up. There should not be, it's almost an oxymoron that they say, well, illegal immigrants haven't broken the law. The first word in that sentence was illegal.
Yes.
I'm just like most of the folks listening, I am the descendant of legal immigrants who waited their turn and followed the rules. And I'm expected to follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I'm expected to pay my taxes on time. I'm expected to stop at a red light. I'm expected to follow the rules of my employment, whether they're safety rules or withholding tax. I'm expected to follow all the rules. My children were expected to do the same. It is absolutely appropriate, especially if we are going to continue to remain as a republic, to say, yeah, the rules apply to everybody. There isn't one class that somehow is outside of the purview of the law. That's just wrong. And it doesn't just destroy one city. It actually tears at the entire fabric of who we are as a nation, because we are sending the message to our children that, well, the rules don't have to apply, only sometimes, only if I want them to. And I should be allowed to ignore the rules I don't like, because that's what sanctuary cities are saying to the next generation. And that is not a message we want to be giving anybody.
That's right. That's right. Well, Peg, I, for one, am very glad that you have thrown your hat in the ring to run for this position. I think your qualifications will speak for themselves, your common sense approach to things. We need organization and common sense in government. Heavens
knows. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. If your listeners want to get involved, the website is PA4PEG.com. There's a Facebook page. There's actually a phone number that they can call in every morning and hear a message. I tell you maybe a suggestion for the day, where I'm going to be if I'm traveling at that moment. This campaign prays together at noon every day, and we remind people. I actually have a reminder in my phone, so it beeps at me because you get busy and you forget. So I have this little ring-a-ding in my phone. And just to take, 2 minutes and stop in the middle of your day, and we try to remember each other and our families and the Commonwealth. And as time goes forward, we'll probably have other particular intentions that we're praying for. But, Benjamin Franklin in the Constitutional Convention reminded them that if they did not begin with prayer, they wouldn't get anywhere. And I am a firm believer in that. So we pray at noon every day. They can call the number. It's right on the website. And every day on the site, there's a brand new video. It's about 3 minutes long. And each one deals with a particular small area. So today's is about the lieutenant governor. In the days ahead, we'll be talking about the right to life and liberty and education and taxes, so that people can kind of look at and learn a little bit about me in tiny little bites. And they're available on Facebook, so they can share them with their friends and their family and their neighbors.
Okay, well, there you have it, folks. Peg Luksic, and her last name is spelled L-U-K-S-I-K. If you want to find out more information about Peg, go to the website, PA4PEG.com. And thank you, Peg, for taking time, and we will make sure that this interview is put up on our website, and we hope people will feel free to share that on Facebook and various places so that you will become known to these people who will be going to the polling place.
Well, thank you so much, Jane. Have a great day.
You have been listening to the Venango County Tea Party Patriots audio interviews with the candidates. We encourage all voters to vote. Every election is important. It is a patriot's duty to exercise this right. Thank you for taking time to be an informed voter. Please continue to check our website at www.vcttpp.org for more educational resources.